Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. We've got a bumper episode this week as me and Dallas King share our Sundance London experiences and reviews and bring you a range of interviews with the writers, directors, actors and musicians involved in the festival this year. So Dallas, welcome back to Scotland. How was your first in-person UK festival here since last February?
Indeed, it seems crazy when you put it like that. I guess I'm slightly luckier than you in that I had an in-person festival around about 11 months ago when I went to Venice, name drop. But yeah, I think since Venice, I think I worked out that other than about 6-7 hour round trip to Glasgow for a press screening, I think it's the first time that I've been away from Aberdeen for more than 7-8 hours. So it was quite a culture shock, especially given the different levels of restrictions between Scotland and England. I think it was quite eye-opening, I think, to be down there and seeing that it's pretty much masks off and in the face of COVID and just like, we're just going to enjoy ourselves now. What about yourself?
Yeah, I found it quite surreal. It was one of those ones, like, I hadn't been in London really properly. I'd been there sort of October 2019 for London Film Festival, and then I spent an afternoon and an evening there last January, which amounted to my only time leaving Scotland. And it was so surreal to sort of return back and realize how much muscle memory there is about, like, you walk to this place, or like, it's only so many steps from one cinema to the other, or I can get from that screening to that screening in like no time at all. It was just so nice to be back, a very different place to return to, you know, especially even things like going down Soho and you see like the streets are now like eating out and drinking out in the streets. It felt very different and kind of exciting as well.
Yeah, I think I had the same thing. As soon as I stepped on into the London Underground, and it was that case of you're walking fast but people are walking slow and you're trying to weave in between them all and stuff like that, and you're like, why are people not in a hurry and stuff like that. It's like it was straight back into that. So it was like, yeah, it just like took a couple of minutes and then suddenly you click, you're back into London time.
Yeah, I think we were safe to say we were starting to tire of virtual festivals. They've had huge bonuses and benefits, but in terms of maybe engaging with the films, we've struggled a little bit at times. But I think it's safe to say being back in the flesh, like the energy, the buzz, networking, and being in the room with people makes such a difference to the experience. It just felt really rewarding to have like those few days.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be interesting to get your opinion on certain films, because I was lucky enough to do Sundance virtually in January. So I'd seen several of the films already, but indeed I had watched them either on a very small iPhone or my laptop. And the couple of films which I saw for a second time, it was interesting to see how my reactions changed from being able to see it on a big screen and with an audience. So it's going to be interesting to see your thoughts on a certain number of titles, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we'll start first off with the Sparks Brothers. So the documentary from Edgar Wright, which looked at the history of the band Sparks. We were lucky enough to speak with Edgar Wright and Ron and Russell Mayle from Sparks about the making of the movie on the red carpet. So here's Ron, Russell and Edgar.
We're entering the summer of Sparks with this documentary, and also Annette, to all of you, but also to Edgar in particular, how does it feel about this film potentially being the spark that lights the fire of fandom in a new generation, as well as celebrating it for all the fans that are already out there?
Well, I think, you know, I believe that, like, a lot of music documentaries, even the really good ones, sometimes just assume prior knowledge, and I think, you know, if something's genuinely timeless, you shouldn't do that. And so really the film is like a celebration for fans and an introduction for others, and I thought that's a really important thing to do, because I wanted people who didn't know the band to love them like I do, and that was basically my goal for the movie.
How do you think it feels about being introduced to potentially a new generation of fans, as well as being loved by the ones who've loved you throughout your career.
Well, you know, we're really pleased with the fact that the documentary can work on those kinds of both levels, you know. And you know, the one thing we're really happy about is just that, you know, maybe it's presumptuous of us, but we feel that we share a certain amount of sensibility with Edgar, and you know, so it was kind of a marriage made in heaven when this all came together.
I have nothing more to add.
A marriage made in heaven in the platonic sense.
Of course.
Although that could change by the end of the night.
Yeah, you never know.
My big takeaway from the documentary is that you're a band that's always looking forward. What's it been like as an exercise to look back on your decades in the industry and how things have changed and evolved for you?
Well, I think the way Edgar framed the whole saga was really appealing to us. That you know, what struck us the most, well, I think, and one of the things Edgar wanted to stress with the film is that Sparks has a really unusual career arc. That it's not typical of a band that has 25 albums to now be having this sort of resurgence in, you know, in the awareness of the band, and, you know, having a film that opened the Cannes Film Festival, having a documentary by, you know, amazing director Edgar, you know, and so all of that stuff, I think, is something that Edgar wanted to stress in the documentary, that what Sparks is doing now kind of is really not kind of consistent with a band with a long history, and that for the people that don't know the band, that hopefully there'll be new converts after seeing this, and that for the people that do know the band, I think they're going to just really love the film.
As a Sparks fan and as a fan of Musi documentaries, I found myself saying aloud to friends, why hasn't somebody done a documentary about Sparks? And sort of as a fan being aggrieved on their behalf. So I guess I willed it into existence. It took me a while to realize that I was going to make the documentary about Sparks, but that's how it came about.
For us, it just... we're huge fans of Edgar's work, and so when the idea was proposed to do a documentary about the band, we said yes. Where in the past we had some hesitations, not feeling that the people that had approached us were the right people to make a film about the band. We sometimes think that our music speaks louder than we do speaking about our music, and so. But when Edgar approached us, we're such a fan, and we think that his sensibility of what he does visually and his narrative, you know, would really be, you know, just really work perfectly for telling the Sparks story. And you know, it's partly just Edgar's passion too, because the process was a 3-year-long process, and, you know, to keep everybody fired up, to have somebody leading the show that's that passionate about the project, it was just, you know, it was just a joy to make the film as well. And the end result, we're just, you know, over the moon.
It was amazing for us because we work in such a closed-off kind of way, so to know that all of these people that Edgar assembled for the documentary in some way were affected by what we were doing, both recently and in the past, was really truly inspiring to us. And one really key thing for the documentary is that Edgar did all of the interviews himself, and so it isn't just kind of stiff people talking in an academic kind of way. Everybody is conversational and personal, so it really gave a different kind of atmosphere in the documentary than what you might typically see in a musical documentary.
We were just really excited that the cast of just musicians alone that Edgar interviewed for the documentary were from just different genres of music, even, and kind of the juxtaposition of, you know, from Duran to Sex Pistols and kind of everything in between was amazing for us. And then that it was not only just musicians, but there's writers like Neil Gaiman analyzing album covers of Sparks, and TV producers like the Paladinos and the Gilmore Girls and all talking about the band. It was just really amazing and heartwarming for us to see how Sparks has had some effect on all these really great creative people.
So Dallas, were you a fan of Sparks before or after watching the movie?
I'm going to be completely honest, like someone on the red carpet had the balls to say to Ron and Russell that, he said that before this film, I'd never heard of you. I had heard of them. I think I knew of the, that Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us song, but I wasn't hugely familiar with Sparks. I mean, I was essentially coming to this film as an Edgar Wright fan. And I mean, I think this is part of the appeal of the film, is that there will be an entire subset of Edgar Wright fans who have never heard of Sparks before, but come to this film and probably will come away at least having learned a lot, or potentially also having a new favorite band. Certainly we'll probably have a few Spotify playlists on rotation from afterwards. I think it was a very thorough, I think it's safe to say it's a very thorough documentary. It goes through pretty much all 25 albums that they've released over the last 50 years, leaves no stone unturned, no celebrity uninterviewed about their love of Sparks. I think you've got some opinions on the number of people interviewed and the quality of the people interviewed. You know, fair enough to hear from musicians about how they were influenced by Sparks, but do we really need to hear from, you know, TV actors and stuff about, you know, their love of the band? Arguable. But I mean, I certainly came away with a great respect for Sparks, and I've definitely been listening to a lot more of their music. And actually, one of the surprising things was just how many Sparks songs I actually knew or were aware of. I just never knew that they were Sparks. So a really sort of great introduction to a band. I mean, it's celebratory, but I think Ron and Russell, I think they were talking in sort of interviews and stuff like that, that they'd been reticent to do a full documentary up until this point, because it almost would have seemed like a bit of a footnote or obituary, like a sort of lifetime achievement, a bit on the basically saying, you know, you've done a great job, but now you're coming to an end and whatever. So they were worried about that. But I think they were fans of Edgar Wright's films and stuff like that. And then they sort of developed a friendship in person before Edgar Wright sort of approached them and said, why has no one done a documentary on me? And they were basically like, well, why don't you? And yeah, that's how it all came together, I guess.
Yeah, I was the same as you. I didn't realize how much Sparks I knew until afterwards. Like, I knew, like, obviously The Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, but if someone asked me to name that band, I wouldn't have said Sparks. I'd have been like, oh, I don't know. But I did know the FSS album, which is one of my favourites for my running playlist. That's the collaboration that they did with Franz Ferdinand. Great title name. And I think someone summed up in the documentary, like, do people realise how lucky Franz Ferdinand are to make an album with Sparks? And yeah, I really enjoyed the film by and large. I think my main problem with it would be, like, I felt it was a little bit overkill on sort of the, as you say, sort of the musicians and people that were influenced by it, you know, a range of sort of celebrities kind of weighing in on Sparks and so on. Like, I get that Sparks have had a lot of influence on a lot of people, but I felt that message was quite clear early on, and I felt that could have been time that might could have been given a little bit more to Ron and Russell, or some of the later years when kind of Sparks were going through a bit more challenging times. I'd love to kind of have had a bit more of an insight into what was the critical reaction to that music at the time that was sort of turning them off. I think that's something I would have maybe just preferred. But, you know, who knows what I suspect with Edgar Wright. You know, I always think I upgraded to Blu-ray to get Scott Pilgrim on Blu-ray because it had great special features that the DVD didn't have. So when Sparks comes out, I think we'll definitely get a nice package of extra scenes and so on that I think might add to the movie even further.
Absolutely, because, yeah, I don't know what it was about the film. I think it was, like, through following, like, Edgar Wright on social media and stuff like that. And when he was filming it, he was like, spending a lot of time with him in, like, Tokyo at a lot of gigs and stuff like that. And I don't know if it was, like, coming off the back of the David Byrne's American Utopia film that Spike Lee did. But I almost had it in my head when I was about to sit down and watch it that I was going to be watching, like, a concert-type film. So when it was actually just a pure sort of documentary, I was kind of surprised, but it was, you know, equally enjoyable. You know, I would still like to see, maybe like you say, there might be some footage of on the Blu-ray extras of maybe Edgar Wright sort of filming some of their concert stuff. That would be good to see. But I did find it funny.
Well, he actually does have a film coming out at the BFI next week, like a one night only screening, where I think he filmed a Sparks concert, I think, well, in London.
Maybe that's what I was thinking of. But yeah, no, I mean, if that's an extra, maybe like a double disc Blu-ray or something, I'd certainly either rent or purchase, maybe even purchase, depending on the price.
I look forward to that digital release.
Yes, but I mean, I did appreciate the fact that, I mean, I saw this back in January, and I don't know what the original plan for it was. Obviously, COVID has changed a lot of plans, but I do find it quite amusing and quite beneficial, actually, for both films, actually, that this is coming out pretty much at the same time as Annette, because there's a scene towards the end of the documentary where Edgar Wright is visiting them on the set of a musical that they have written the music for, being directed by Leo Carax and starring Adam Driver. And it just turns out that that movie was the Cannes opening gala film, Annette, and that is out in a couple of weeks. So it's like they've almost got this basic sort of a trailer almost for this musical that's coming out, and it was almost like the Leonardo DiCaprio Once Upon a Time Hollywood meme, where you sort of see that scene in the end and you're like, oh my god, that's the movie that I'm really looking forward to watch at the Edinburgh Film Festival. Well, probably on the P&I screening, not the public screening, because it's all sold out already.
The Summer of Sparks. So I think this is one we're not going to dive into too much at this stage, because we're going to save our deep dive until the film's released later this month. But I think one of the most anticipated movies for me, and even you, even though you've seen the film several times, is Censor. So after viewing a strangely familiar video nasty, Enid, a film censor, sets out to solve the past mystery of her sister's disappearance, embarking on a quest that dissolves the line between fiction and reality. So we'll drop a more detailed interview with the film's co-writer and director, Prana.
And indeed, a deep dive, I think it's going to be safe to say.
Absolutely, yeah. We'll be speaking later this month. But for now, we've got an interview with the film star Niamh Algar and Bond on the red carpet talking with Dallas at the UK premiere.
Congratulations on the film. I loved your performance. It was absolutely fantastic. I mean, when approaching a role such as this, I mean, Prano really puts you through the ringer here. I was just wondering, did it affect you sort of going home? I'm just wondering, do you sort of self-censor films nowadays when you come off the set and you're like watching something at home, or you're sort of watching it and going, oh, I'd maybe cut that, or...
It's a really good point. Someone said that to me. It was like, now that when you go into acting, you're going to look at films differently. You'll never be able to look at them with like a non-objective eye. But no, I think that's the magic of storytelling, is it allows you to be immersed, especially in a theatre. You forget how immersive an experience being in a cinema is. With the sound, aesthetically, I'm so excited to see a film, especially censored, that is, it was designed to be watched in a cinema. But yeah, she did. She put me through the ringer.
Yeah, and did you trust her all the way? I mean, her vision and stuff like that.
Yeah. We had like an amazing correspondence before we started filming, back and forth, just kind of tonally figuring out what it was that she wanted to accomplish, and just with the character. And so going into it, like, I couldn't have been more prepared. And also, like, you know, if you have a director that is emotionally in the scenes with you, like, literally she was going through all the emotions that I did, it just allows you to kind of commit to the moment even more so, because she understands emotionally how the character is.
How did you know
me
was going to be able to pull off a transformative role as the movie comes along?
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about the character while I was writing, I was really thinking about who do I need, you know, to carry the film, because essentially this person is going to carry us through every single scene from beginning to end, and it's all about Enid. So I knew I had to find someone electric on screen who we wouldn't want to look away from. And when I saw Niamh in The Virtues, that's how I felt when I saw her performing. But then I watched pretty much everything else she'd done, and I just saw how chameleon-like she is. And I'd already met her through the Screen International Stars of Tomorrow. But then when she came in to read, like, I knew how brilliant and lovely she was already, but when she came in to read, she just managed to kind of really encapsulate this kind of cocooned character at the front of the film and this, like, nuance that we needed because Enid's very close. And then when we read the latter scenes, she just sort of blasted us into this kind of emotional stratosphere that I wasn't even expecting to go to. So I knew that, you know, not only did she have the kind of the talent and the skills to take us there, but also I really enjoyed communicating with her, and I really enjoyed spending time with her, and I knew that this was somebody that I'd be able to kind of continue developing the character with. So yeah, I'm so lucky to have got the chance to work with her. I think she's going to be off to stardom next, I imagine.
Dallas, this has been, as I mentioned, you've seen this film already. Anyone that's followed you on social media has seen the poster, will know that you are this film's biggest fan. One of those things that, you know, you had such a great experience with it, watching it at home on your kind of screener. What was it like to finally turn it into a big screen experience?
I think the easiest way to describe it would be, imagine that I am Bradley Whitford in Get Out, and I would basically say I'd give it 6 stars if I could. Honestly, having seen it on a laptop and whatever twice, you know, I saw it on my phone, and then I'd rented it from US iTunes, so I saw it on my telly. I've graduated on the big screen, and honestly, it is still my number one film of the year. The seeing it on the big screen was just incredible, and for me, it was the sound mix more than anything that I was able to appreciate this time around. The sound mix is absolutely fantastic, but just the look of it as well. It's another one which I think we'll get onto to Zola towards the end, but seeing it on a laptop or your iTunes, it looks quite polished, whereas on the screen, on the big screen, you can really sort of feel the sort of the texture of the film. You know, this one was shot on sort of like 35mm to sort of give a bit more of this sort of 80s graininess, and you can really sort of feel that on the big screen. And also watching it on your own and watching it with an audience is, you know, watching a horror film, especially with an audience, it's a fantastic experience when people sort of get the same scares, but also a lot more of the humour sort of came through, particularly the wonderful Michael Smiley. He just sort of cracked me up on my own, and also it was great to see that the audience really responded to his character. But I mean, everyone knows what I think. It's got 5 stars on the poster, which is like a really huge geeky moment for me. I'm really interested to see how you felt and if it could possibly have led up to the hype that I've been going on about for about 7 months now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really keen to, you know, I'm going to keep a lot of my powder dry until I go see it again. I'm planning to watch it or rent it before we have our discussion with, of course, we're going to have Kim on to talk about that one. But I think it's safe to say the hype did live up to it for me. I was... the first few seconds, I think the first people, I think, can't remember who the first, card comes up on, you know, from in terms of producers. But I think when it went to like, had like a traditional one, and then it went to like an old retro film 4-1 and BFI mm-hmm. one, a mixture one. I remember turning to my friend that I was watching with, went, I think I'm going to love this film. And I really enjoyed the experience of it. I think I can see why people are desperate to watch this again and to talk about things, because I really enjoyed my first time watching it. I kind of let the film wash over me. It's such a deep and layered film. There's so much going on visually. There's so much going on with the story, with the production design. It's incredibly well put together that in this sort of 90 minutes, in that first watch, you can only just let it flow over you. And I really want to be able to watch it again, to pick at certain things and like to watch how they did something, to really focus on perhaps like the video nasties that they made, you know, think about some of the exciting theories that are kind of going on around about the film. There's just so much there that it's such a rich film that one watch doesn't do it justice. But yeah, it certainly lived up to the hype, and you know, I'm not the biggest horror fan in the world, but it tapped into the type of film that I kind of like, this sort of Barbarian Sound Studio style film where there's a lot of sensory elements kind of involved, and you really get deep into the mind of a character and you come away wondering, what's real, what's not. You know, there's so much ways that you can skin a film like this, and as I say, one watch does not do it justice. And with a running time like that, it's so exciting to be able to think, I'm going to be able to watch a hell of a... I could watch this 3-4 times over the course of the week and probably not get bored and give up too much of a time commitment. So, yeah, I'm going to keep my powder dry a couple more weeks. I need to definitely watch this one again.
Yeah, no, there's so much going on. I think, like you say, it's like Shrek would say, it's like an onion. It has layers and you can peel off and see what you think is going on. Just to quickly tease, but we do get into that slightly with Prano. Well, I do, because I have a very detailed theory and I present some of that to her. So you'll be able to hear that part of the interview and also probably hear Lee chuckling in the background about it.
It was a moment to admire. I mentioned it to a friend afterwards where I was like, I'm so happy Dallas got that moment where you're like, you've been obsessed with this film for 7 months and then you get your moment with like the director to go, this is my thoughts that's built up in my head and so on. And it was just wonderful to watch. Like, we, I think as film fans and people that think about these sorts of things, when you get that moment where you can, you know, we have it on things like the A24 project where there's films that I love and the chance to talk with, you know, the people involved in it and just to share and chat about the films, like that is always exciting. And, you know, sometimes you can go to these press things and it can be a bit dry. It's a bit sort of like, everyone's there to do a job, but I was just marveling going, I'm so glad Dallas got that moment. It was like 7 months in the making, but yeah, I thought it was very special.
Oh yeah, no, we're totally BFFs now. Yeah, no, we ended up basically sat next to each other watching Zola and stuff like that. So yeah, I've gone into a bit more detail with her on this and actually sent her my, which is at the currently about 1100 word theory. And you know, she's taken it all in the best possible way, and the fact that she loves the fact that there's going to be people out there sort of picking at all the different references and coming up with their own theories. Obviously she has her own one and she's not telling me what the truth is, because you know, that's the best thing, you know, it's the ambiguity of it that allows everyone to have an interpretation of what's going on. And I think I have to say that part of that is probably also down to the incredible performance by Neve Algar in this film. I mean, she's someone that I haven't really seen much of before. I've seen she's fantastic in the sort of Cam with Horses film, which is currently now available to watch on Netflix. She's great in that, but here she's just so extraordinary. You know, she plays like this person who is very sort of prim, proper, very repressed to begin with, but slowly but surely, you know, things start to unravel into a cacophony of violence at the end, and it is, yeah, a wonder to behold, and yeah, very exciting things I think ahead for Neve Algar. I mean, what did you make of her performance? Very, very quickly, I know we're going to have a whole episode dedicated to this, but I'm just keen to get your initial thoughts on her performance.
I thought I knew her. Like, I thought I'd seen her in something or recognised her, maybe I'd interviewed her before, but I think she's got that face where it's like, I think that's what makes the character so interesting, is you go, she's very relatable. Like, the trauma that she's going through may not be, but she does have that rare thing in a kind of horror or thriller movie where you're like, I think I might know her or something like that. And there's something about that that just gets into your head. And I think that almost adds to the film as well, where the character's going through something similar. So yeah, I thought she was fantastic casting. And I think she's starring in an upcoming Channel 4 show as well. So yeah, her performance was so fantastic. I can't wait to see what she does next.
Absolutely.
So talking about prim and proper, Zola. So as listeners will know, we have our own A24 podcast. So we'll be diving into Zola in much more detail on that from Friday's episode. So it was obviously good to see a couple of new A24 films in the cinema, Dallas. Were you excited? Because I know these were two films that you were determined to get your tickets to.
I wasn't actually, just with work and stuff like that, I wasn't able to get down for the press screenings because they took place like Monday to Wednesday, and the film festival itself took place Thursday to Sunday. And having seen several of the films before, I wanted to really make sure that I was going to be down to potentially interview some of the people involved. So I'd booked my ticket for Sensor on the Big Screen, and then I booked for the closing gala of Zola. But then we got the chance to speak to the writer, co-writer, director, Janice Bravo, at a round table and on the red carpet, and then me being me, I was like, well, I don't want to be that person to do a wishy-washy question about, oh, did you enjoy making the film, or what did you make of the Twitter thread when you first read it? So I ended up watching the film in my hotel room through my US iTunes account on the morning of the round table. So, and in some ways, yeah, it kind of works watching it on a sort of phone that you use for social media, given the plot. But again, this was a film which truly did benefit from that big screen experience, because it's how it plays with a packed crowd as well. I think, you know, you could be sort of shocked at the events that take place, but I think experiencing it with a crowd is a whole other thing as well. So, I mean, what did you make of it on first one? Because you saw it at the press screening, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose let's hear that interview and bring it to life first. So here's the interview with the co-writer and director.
You've spoken previously at the round table about how you had a bit more creative license with the characters of, say, like X and Stephanie, because you hadn't met them. Working closely with sort of Isaiah Zola on the script and the story, when did you know that Taylor Page was the one to be able to bring this character to the big screen, and also to do justice to Zola, and also to be able to take the audience on what is quite an extreme story?
You know, we met over 700 girls for the part. When I got the film, one of the things that I had been kind of using in my pitch was that here was an opportunity for us to cast what would be referred to in our industry as an unknown. I think that word can be a little bit yucky, but there was an opportunity to cast someone who maybe had had less credits. And so we did this very wide search across the country, and I was scouring Facebook and Instagram and sending girls to my casting director, and they were, you know, sending in monologues. And in that period, I had been home, and I saw, like, the end of this ad, what I thought was an ad, and I saw this girl in it. And I tried to describe her to my casting director. I was like, she's black, she thinks dances, she's pretty, do you know who she is? And, of course, that doesn't make any sense, or is 100 million people. So I think it's maybe a month before we finally get Taylor, or a few weeks before we finally get Taylor, I'm sitting at this coffee shop in LA, and she walks in, the girl from that ad, and I was like, oh my god, it's her. And so I take my phone out, I take a picture of her, she sees me take the picture, she is not okay with me doing that, because I didn't know she'd been on a television show, a Miss VH1 television show that I had never watched, so I guess she thought I was just like some asshole, right, taking her picture. But I send it to my casting director. My casting director goes, oh, that's Taylor Page. And I was like, yes, that's who I was telling you that I saw on television. Cut to, she comes in, she reads for it, and I just knew it was something in my gut. I mean, like I said, when I saw those 20 seconds on television, or 7 seconds, 8 seconds, whatever it was, I just, something told me it was her. And it is pretty symbiotic with how I arrived at the script too. I read the text and just kind of knew this is supposed to be the film I'm working on. And it isn't particularly scientific, it just was. And I think it's my gut.
So yeah, we'll have a much more detailed interview with her on the A24 project. Hopefully that whets your appetite. But yeah, I really enjoyed Zola. Maybe not as much as I hoped to. I'm kind of keen to see it again. I think it certainly made for an interesting double bill with the next film we're about to talk about, Pleasure. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I think it's incredibly well crafted. And it's one of those things, having had the interview now with the director, there's a lot of things that I perhaps didn't pick up on or took for granted with the making of the film. So I'm keen to kind of go back in. And there's a part of me that's curious to see what that James Franco version would have looked like. I hadn't realized until then that he was originally attached to direct it, but I think this film was in the right hands, and you know, I'm really excited to see what she does next. And I love Riley Keough, the cast is fantastic. I just find the character somewhat of Zola a bit passive, you know, just there on sort of the periphery, and I guess there's an element of that where it's like the character watching things unfold, but I feel like our titular character just sort of falls a little bit through the cracks.
I think, yeah, that was my issue with the character, and it's something I sort of alluded to in my question to Janitsa, that, you know, she is essentially almost like reacting to things, and she's almost a passenger in her own story because she's being swept along by these, certainly in the film anyway, characters who are allowed to sort of be bigger, bolder, swinging for the fences, certainly with some of the artistic choices that Coleman Domingo and Riley Keough choose to do. So, I mean, it's finding that person who the audience can empathise with and, you know, take her on this journey with them. So, I mean, Taylor Page is good. It's just that, yes, I think there is some issues with the central character being potentially sort of as passive as she is. But I guess it's basically part and parcel with the story, and it's a very entertaining one. But yes, it does have some flaws, but it is a wild ride.
Well, talking about wild rides, pleasure. I wish we could say we had these.
Didn't even plan it.
Yeah, I wish we could say we had these planned. But pleasure. 20-year-old Bella Cherry leaves the small town life in Sweden for Los Angeles with the aim to become the world's biggest next porn star. But her road to her goal turns out to be bumpier than she imagined. So, Dallas, you unfortunately missed this one at Sundance, and then in typical fashion, A24 picked this one up afterwards. So what was your expectations going into this one? This is one that down the line, I'm not too sure of when the American release date will come, but this is one we'll dive into properly in the A24 project. But what was your expectations going into Pleasure? Because it had some mixed reviews, I think.
Yeah, I think I went in having heard some interesting things about the press screening. and fair warning, I think after the press screening, I went to the public screening, and that was introduced by Claire Binns, the joint managing director of Picture House in Sundance, London. And she basically sort of gave a rather detailed trigger warning about, you know, you will be confronted with images and storylines that not everyone is going to be comfortable with. Fair warning, you know, if you do need to leave at any point, you know, there is a safe space that someone can go to recover from what they've just seen. And indeed, I think the opening scene is intentionally provocative and confrontational and sort of sets the starlight right from the beginning as she's plunged head first, pardon the pun, into that world. But I think I went in expecting a bit more of like a gritty, almost, I don't know why, but maybe slightly sort of documentary, mockumentary-esque expose of the porn industry. And I was actually very surprised that once we get into the story, it is almost sort of like a standard Hollywood sort of, you know, rags to riches, you know, naive, beautiful young starlet comes to Hollywood expecting to make it big. There's an attractive rival for, you know, the top spot. You know, she discovers that everything is not as what it seems, and she needs to work harder. She needs to decide how far she's willing to go to get what she wants. And then when she does get it, you know, is she still the person that she wanted to be? You know, be careful what you wish for, kind of thing. So yeah, I was surprised at the plotting and the formulaic sort of structure of it. But I mean, I don't think I can take anything away from the committed and fearless performance of Sofia Coppola. I think she's going to be a star in her own right. And I think there were some very bold and dramatic choices from the director, Ninja Thyberg. Not all of it works. I wasn't completely convinced by the end. I think it does sort of stop rather abruptly. I mean, yes, it probably fits in with the character's story, but I can't help but feeling slightly maybe let down and deflated, I think, at the ending of it. What about yourself?
Yeah, I think the ending is a little bit kind of maybe a little bit of a cop-out, but for me it was one of my favorite Sundance movies, and I don't know what I expected going in. I think the joy of film festivals sometimes is you kind of go into these things as dark as possible. Like, I knew this was like an A24 film. Well, A24 were distributing in America about a porn star. I didn't know anything beyond that. I knew I had received some mixed reviews. And I think within that first few minutes, like, the tone's a little bit jokey. It's kind of like, you know, kind of girl goes to sort of the big city. You know, I'm kind of, you know, I think there's a great line in it where she's like, is there any part of LA that you want to see that's not just like a porn studio? It's not like it's a glamorized LA. It's like an LA in the suburbs and, you know, the outskirts, etc. And there's a moment where I've never experienced it in a press screening before. There is a moment about 12 minutes in with people are going to be talking nonstop about the Green Knight and cum. There is an incredible cum scene in Pleasure. So A24 is definitely earning a reputation in 2021 for cum scenes. But where it literally drove someone to run out of our screening with their bag. I've never seen anything like that, and it got one of the biggest laughs of the screening. I really, really enjoyed Pleasure. Well, naturally. It's one of those things, I just think it was so shocking that, you know, you're so used to going into films and being desensitized to things, and like, you kind of turn up and go, well, I know how A, B, and C will get there. With something like this, I was like, oh wow, like, they're leaning into this, and I'm like, how the hell is this film going to be released in America? Like, I think A24 will probably just do select theaters in New York and Los Angeles, and I think this is going to be a movie release here in the UK. I don't know how they're going to release this film. Like, it's one of those ones, like, you can already hear the girl boss discourse kicking off. I can't wait to see how the public reacts to this film and what comes next for it. I just think it's very, very impressive, and the casting is great too, and there's some truly shocking, wild scenes that, you know, it's not, I don't think it's necessarily done for shock factor. It just feels like it's being true to that story. It's not a Showgirls kind of, which I thought this might have been.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's even sort of Boogie Nights, which is the only sort of film I think I can compare it to, but that was a male director and it followed a male sort of porn star's rise and fall in the industry. But I don't think it ever really got into what this sort of deals with, which is there's several scenes where, despite, you know, the women being the main draw in this industry, it's still clearly controlled by men, and some really sort of dark and deeply uncomfortable scenes about how female talent are manipulated into, you know, what's performed on screen. And, you know, you've got them sort of, even like, you've got consent forms that need to be filled in, but they're also videotaped filling in the consent forms, so they then can't, you know, claim later on that they never agreed to certain things and stuff like that. So it's quite an eye-opener, and I think it will, it's intentionally confrontational, and I think it will, people will sort of watch it and then question their own sort of thoughts on the industry and their own sort of habits with watching this sort of thing. So I think it's a fantastic conversation starter. But like you say, I think it's, I can't see how they're going to be able to release it in America in cinemas with anything other than an NC-17. I believe there has been talk of maybe sort of cutting it down, but I think if you do that, you will sort of lose some of the impact of it, I think. And in the UK, I have no idea what movie's going to do with it. Good luck to them, I say.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I look forward to where this film goes, and I'm sure our discussion will be very different once this film gets a US release date. But with the surprise film this year was Herself. So slightly surprising, as that had been a release from last year at LFF, but some of our friends are good detectives and predicted it was going to be Herself. And you had the chance to interview the director, Dallas. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Phyllo Deloyd was at the Sundance Festival initially for a masterclass on the Friday. And then our good friend, Robotty, had theorized that the surprise film might be Herself, because Harriet Walter was down for the press call for the surprise film, and she is a star of Herself, and it kind of makes sense because people were kind of querying, why is Phyllo Deloyd here when she doesn't have a new film? Because Herself had screened it, like you say, at London Film Festival in 2020, and then had screened at Sundance, the Utah version of Sundance, in 2020. So it was like, you know, why is he? So some people correctly theorized that that was a film. I know a lot of people were expecting Mass, which is an incredible film and had initially been announced for Sundance last London, but then got pulled. So people were thinking, oh, it's maybe the surprise film or potentially the Christopher Abbott starring On the Count of Three. But no, it was Herself. So when we spoke to Phyllo, it was on the Friday before we knew that this was going to be the film that was going to be showing at Sundance, but we were able to talk about Herself and some of the themes behind it. The fact that she worked with the lead actress, Claire Vaughan, was also the writer of the script. It was very sort of personal and passionate project for them both, and then also sort of talking about other themes within the film, and then also how it tied into her larger body of work, which is always about promoting strong female voices on the screen. the film was written by Claire and starring, was that always the plan for her to play the lead role?
Actually, when she first wrote the screenplay, she wasn't going to play Sandra and I wasn't going to direct it. When she gave it to me to read the first time, she was thinking of playing maybe a small sister role that she'd written in it. She was thinking, actually, you know, this was so far from being a sort of vanity project. She wanted this story to be told. It didn't matter how, you know, what she had to do to get it made. It somehow the story had to get out there. And I was thinking, ooh, you know, this is a very Dublin story. We were working together in the theatre. We were very close friends and colleagues. And I was giving her feedback about the screenplay and thinking, you know, maybe this should be directed by an Irish director. And then gradually, as I got more involved with it, I began to think, actually, not only did I become really sort of committed to what she was trying to do, but I also thought, if I get involved with this, maybe I can insist that she plays the lead. You know, I'd heard someone say, God, Claire's written a role here for a great leading movie actress. I heard this being said and I was like, yeah, her. You know, her. Not who you know, as if they were saying we could bring someone over from America, you know, to play the lead in this because it's such a tour de force. And so I thought, yeah, that's the point at which I was like, yeah, sod this, I'm gonna direct it. And on some other level I also felt that though it was a really Irish story, there's something about being an outsider that where you can help to make it also a global story because the themes are actually completely universal and we're suffering, you know, a housing crisis that's slightly different in its ingredients here, but it's no less acute.
I can't remember which one, but I'm sure there was a quote someone said that there's universality and the specific, or something. The more specific a story is, the more people you can kind of reach with it.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
I can't remember who quoted it, but yes. I think one thing I noticed about the ending of the film, not to get to spoilers, but obviously she does suffer that setback at the end, and I was just thinking that if it had been, say, like a larger production or whatever, I can imagine certain studio executives might have been pushing for we would like a happier ending, sort of, but then skipping over the point that it's about her journey and the strength she gets to prove that she can do all of this herself, and then she's rebuilt a house. She's built a house once, but she's also rebuilt her life and she can do it again. Were there any sort of conversations or pushback on that?
Yeah, I mean, we had, you know, throughout this, fantastic support from producers. Sharon Horgan, Rory Gilmartin, and Ed Guiney of Element, who just were very aligned. There was a point in one of the drafts where other members of the community were, without again getting into spoilers, you saw more of the community at the end of the film. And I was having sort of misgivings about, ooh, I think I know that movie where everybody comes out of the woodwork and the score swells. And I remember somebody saying, you could shoot two endings. And thinking, maybe we won't do that. Because this is a film about Sandra and her kids, ultimately. That's how it begins. Yeah, it's interesting. But that's the beauty of working. I mean, I have to say I've been lucky. I've had such a crazy sort of pattern to my film involvement because of having sort of, apart from one very off-the-wall indie thing I did earlier on, but starting properly at a sort of very big budget, and then I've been sort of going, doing the opposite of what most people do. I've been trying to go backwards down to down to ground zero, and to be able to be, have my hands more kind of, as it were, on the earth. And but I've been lucky in terms of for different reasons on each movie not to have to be backed into a corner to make, you know, to do things that you don't want to do. And that's a combination of having, in this country, you know, we have some impressive people running some of the funding bodies, like whether it's BBC Film, who will kind of help support you hold true to what you're trying to do.
Sort of looking at the sort of films that you've done, there's a sort of common theme of the sort of strong female characters, and in particular motherhood. I guess if you look at Margaret Thatcher as the mother of Great Britain at the time or whatever, potentially it leads on to the thing. Is it? I'm just wondering, is that when you're looking at these projects and choosing to zoom, is it the story, or is it the chance to work in different genres? Because you had like that sort of biopic, you've done a musical, you've done a drama. Is it the chance to do something different, or has it always sort of come down to the story?
Well, it's definitely, you know, it's jobs for the girls, there's no question of that. And it isn't even, you know, when people point it out to me, I sort of think, oh gosh, it clearly strikes people as sort of distinctive that you would follow a female. But to me, it's like, it's as natural as it might be to somebody else to go, I'm just going to do films about boys, you know. I just can't even begin to say how, to me, it just feels like I went to an all-girls school where we played all the parts. So when I left school and suddenly went to see a play and there's only like two tiny roles for women, I'm like, sorry, hang on, we've got to get back to the programme here and get at least a balance. So, and you know, there are so many stories that haven't been told that feature women at the centre. I guess it's just been it's just the way it's rolled. And yeah, there's a big feminist agenda. You know, I want the world to be different. And I think we're still. We've got a hell of a way to go, and lots more stories to tell.
Well, that was a fantastic interview, Dallas. So what were some of the, I suppose you had a bit of a limited time with the films here, but looking back on Sundance 2021 for you overall, what were some of maybe the highlights or recommendations for people to seek out when the films do come to the cinema, or to keep an eye out for in the future when they'll randomly pop up on some sort of streaming service?
I mean, one of the films, I didn't get a chance to rewatch it this weekend because I was also squeezing in some regular movie going with the likes of Suicide Squad, and then also a trip to the Prince Charles, where I was finally able to redeem my Lifetime membership, and I watched GoldenEye on the big screen. That's a good film. I can hardly recommend GoldenEye. Still cracking after about 25 years or so. But one film which I did want to highlight was, and I think it's out 3rd of September. I don't know if it's in cinemas or a streaming service, but the crazier, wilder than the truth, stranger than fiction documentary, Misha and the Wolves, which I noticed that the Misha and the Wolves official Twitter account used the line which I had in my review, that director Sam Hopkinson must have a back-end deal with a carpet company given the amount of rugs that he pulls out from underneath the audience in this film. And I really enjoyed it. It's if you have been a fan of Tiger King or any of the sort of Netflix documentaries, or even ones like sort of like, you know, Three Identical Strangers over the past couple of years, where you're just sort of scratching your head and wondering where on earth this story is going to go, and then having to spin your head back 180 degrees every sort of 20 minutes, then this is a film for you. might read the synopsis, but I can guarantee you have no idea the places that this documentary is going to go.
I'm 100% with you on that one. I think you'd mentioned this one to me where it was like, check this one out, it'll surprise you. And it was like, yep, good enough for me. And like, all I knew was about, like, I was telling a friend before, it was like, oh yeah, it's about the Holocaust or, you know, some Nazis and wolves. Like, I didn't really know it. And
Nazi
I remember
wolves.
Just, yeah, I remember just sort of going in and being like, it's one of those films where you look at your watch, like a film's like about 90 minutes, and you look at your watch a lot because, as you mentioned, there's so many twists and turns that you go, well, the film, what I expected, it's similar to kind of Three Identical Strangers going, well, that's 20 minutes in, that's the film I expected, what next? And then it continues to take this twist and turn and become even more wild and crazy. And I remember just turning to a mate, like, throughout the film going, there's 45 minutes left, what could possibly happen next? Or, like, it climaxes again, and then there's another twist, and you're like, there's still half an hour, what could possibly happen? It was truly, like, unbelievable, and it's going to be one of these films that's going to be so popular on a streaming service, I have no doubt about that, but I would love to be able to see people watch that in the cinema and just react with people.
Yeah, it does have a cinema release 3rd of September, and then I think it's Storyville, which bought it for the UK, so it will probably be on BBC iPlayer a couple months after. But what I really appreciate about this film is, and I'm not going to spoil it, but there's a certain thing happens. And I had sort of kind of had suspicions leading up to it going, something's slightly off here. But then they reveal what it is, and then it will have you questioning how you accept what you are told in a documentary and the power that a documentary filmmaker has over you in crafting the narrative and the story. And I thought it was absolute genius. And yes, so this one, very, very highly recommended. And another one which has had very good reviews. It won lots of the audience awards at Sundance. I think slightly mixed reviews over here. It is maybe slightly formulaic, but it has fantastic performances and is probably, certainly after the likes of Pleasure and Zola, this is probably one of the more feel-good films of the festival, and this is out soon as well, and that was Coda. What did you make of that one?
Well, I had a journey with Coda where in the first half an hour, I was not enjoying the film whatsoever. I found it a bit naff. Like, they're playing sort of like gospel style music. It's a bit pitch perfect. I was like, oh, sweet Jesus. Like, this is all the things I dislike in films. But there's a moment when it starts to focus on this deaf family. Like, I just became engrossed in the film. I was able to have a cry by the end. I think this film is going to be a huge success, and it's going to have a lot of breakout stars off the back of it. But it was one of the ones, like, my patience was rewarded. Like, I was just rolling my eyes at the beginning going, oh no, this isn't what I want whatsoever. So yeah, it was a total shock for me, and a wonderfully done film. So I think, yeah, it'll be really popular on Apple TV. But for me, probably the star of the festival was In the Same Breath. So it's a documentary that examines behind the scenes, really, on the ground in China, in Wuhan, sort of how the Chinese government handled the pandemic and how they essentially turned it into a bit of a victory for the ruling Communist Party. Incredible, incredible documentary in terms of the footage. I mean, I'm sick of thinking about COVID, dealing with it. You know, it's been horrible. And, you know, the idea of, like, a lot of it's become white noise now to me. You know, I do the right things, I follow the rules. Every so often, you know, I get an update on the changes. But for something like In the Same Breath, it's like, it just provokes so many memories and feelings in you that just fill you with anger, disgust, you know, shock and horror and awe at what goes on in this film. And, you know, where some of these people that the interviews' journeys go is just surprising. Yeah, a fantastic movie, really stunning documentary filmmaking.
I know, I'm really annoyed that I've now attended two versions of Sundance and I have missed this both times. Yeah, I will need to catch this one when it finally does get a full release. I mean, who directed it? Was it I'm not going to say inside job, but was it a Chinese documentary or was it sort of a US bit one that has managed to speak to some people who were able to talk about it within China?
A lot of it was filmed by sort of the director was Chinese, but went back to America sort of at the start of it, but had a team on the ground, you know, of kind of freelance documentary makers that sort of were able to film and record interviews, and things were done over Skype, etc. So it was a real combination. But yeah, it's one of those things, like, if you think you don't want a COVID documentary, there's just something about this which is just, you know, truly shocking and fantastic, you know, just great work. So is there anything else you would recommend? I suppose, as I say, we'll be diving into things like Censor, Zola and Pleasure a lot more in the coming weeks, but any last films you want to give a shout out to?
No, I think that was about everything that I was actually able to catch this time around. Yeah, it's like that thing of, you know, I was wanting to see movies and see films in the cinema, talk to film directors and whatever, but there was also part of me that was just like, I'm outside of Aberdeen for like the first time. I'm going to have a walk around London and stuff and actually taking some of the sights, because I know I'm really bad for that with some film festivals. Like at Venice, I was basically on the boat over to Lido, in a cinema, back. I hardly saw Venice at all, so it was just nice to walk around and catch up with friends and stuff like that. And but yeah, no, I mean, I have to give huge credit to the entire team at Pictures in Sundance London for being able to pull off an in-person festival. Sure, it was relatively small in attendance, so maybe about 15 films over 4 days, but I mean, it flowed seamlessly. You know, the Premier Comms team behind the sorting us out with the access to the talent and stuff like that, making sure we were able to get interviews and everything was great. And yeah, hopefully, fingers crossed, this bodes well for, you know, providing there wasn't a huge COVID outbreak at the after party on Sunday. I think it looks like hopefully we should at least get a hybrid model for London Film Festival in October, which I know you're greatly looking forward to.
Yeah, it's 2 months to go. It's crazy to think. And like, we've got Edinburgh this month, so that'll be a bit of a virtual one for us, but it feels like we're nearly back.
Nature is healing.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, as you say, a huge props and thanks to the team at Picture House and Sundance and everyone that was involved in putting this on. Like, yeah, as I say, it was a small festival in the grand scheme of things, but we need festivals like this to be a success to then fill confidence for larger festivals. So yeah, I felt really safe, confident and happy the whole time, and felt well fed with the morning pastries. So thank you very much.
But I think, yeah, I think there was only, say, like, there was very few filmmakers over. Obviously, the London-based ones were able to attend, but I think Janixa was really the only one from America to come over. And I guess, you know, with the film being released this week, she's able to do a lot more press and stuff like that. But now that I believe travel restrictions have relaxed and that people from the US are now able to come over without quarantining, so hopefully that means that, you know, if there are in-person events and stuff like that at the London Film Festival, we will see more talent being able to come across. Because, you know, all is well about, you know, being able to get a few minutes in interviewing someone over Zoom. But I don't know how you felt, but I think even in the round tables where you're, say, like 4 or 6 sort of people, being able to pick up on, you know, what other people are talking about, or even sort of visual cues from the director, you can kind of see something that maybe sparks an interest in their eyes and whatever, and you can kind of follow up on that and play off it. Whereas if it's just you and you've got your questions, you can sometimes maybe miss out on things. But I think, as you'll be able to see from sort of the full interviews that we've got coming up on the A24 project and on the Censor episode, we were able to, I think, almost get a bit more out of our time with the directors by just being there in person.
Absolutely. So lots to look forward to. We are going to be milking Sundance for all it's worth over the coming weeks and months across various podcasts. So thanks everyone for listening, and thanks again to Sundance London for putting on an event. Cheers.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.